If Murray has supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blah Blah Blah.
Sending out good vibes. Good vibes.
Underneath breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grand America Show. Coming at you this week with Jonathan 12 Hawks. I mean, 10 years in the making, 12 years in the making since the original. I swear it's the Mike Hawk episode with Len Kasten. People can check and see if I'm right or not, but I think that is the intro with the infamous Graham Hawk synchro, which starts off a whole trail of trouble. On that note, we have everybody's favorite podcaster here, Graham Synchro Dunlop.
It might have gone back to, I mean, you said it was 10 years in the making, but it could be 20. I mean, I was in that library in Vancouver when, I mean, I talk about it in the episode with him, but some guy's like, oh, you gotta, he hands me this like audiobook. CDs. It was back when the CDs. It was like, here's a booklet of CDs here. You gotta listen to this book, The Traveler. And that was it, man. So that was like a viral, kind of a viral book, you know, kind of a dystopian, but turned into a series of cool, like techno magic kind of international intrigue series of books. That's just my own like ad-libbed description right there. But yeah, it was pretty cool.
So is it like insert disc two?
Oh yeah. And I would burn my audio. So I was listening to audiobooks. I'd go to the library, go through all these things. I'd get the books, I'd put them in the computer, download them to the iPod and listen to them on the iPod.
You're way ahead of your time. I mean, it's amazing you didn't have a podcast sooner. I mean, honestly, you should be way ahead of the curve.
I even narrated the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps and 12 traditions into a little digital recorder. And then transferred that on my iPod so I could listen to the big book. I do.
We should release it for posterity's sake.
It wasn't like edited or anything. It was real rough.
That's all right. I'll edit it. Nah, I won't. I might end up sober. Yeah. Anyway, we could be back. I booked my.
It might ruin your drinking. Don't listen to that. It'll ruin your drinking.
I did have a martini since I've been back from the island.
Oh, wow.
Well, I mentioned I had to go out to that stupid dinner downtown. So what are you going to do? You know, you're kind of at a bar in that scenario. And I was like, you know what? They got the same martini I've been drinking in on Easter Island. And the thing is the same price. Almost exactly. I bet if you did all the conversion, it's almost exactly the same price. Except I'm pretty sure mine was pretty watered down comparatively. But, or they just have a heavy pour on the island. It's hard to say. But, I mean, there's no comparison. The one on the island is way better. It's just the coffee. That's the thing I miss most about South America. Even in Santiago, the coffee was mint.
Yeah, it was
good. Anything you're going to find here just by nature of how, like, that shit's got to be, I don't know how fresh it is. Some of it's got to be super fresh compared to here. It seems way fresher. I don't know what they're doing different, but the coffee was great everywhere, which I guess would spill over into the espresso martini. And on that, I was going to mention in that, well, A, we locked in the dates for the next Easter Island with Alejandro, which I think you're going to love because it's Easter on Easter Island.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's good.
It's April 12th to 20th, 2028. So people can check that out. contact@thecabin.com. But I was booking my flights for Serpent Mound and they're not great. To be honest, they're not like, you want nothing to be excited about. But after flying all the way to Easter Island and back, I'm like, ah, 4 hours, that's fucking nothing. 4 and 2, that's nothing, man. That's, I could do that standing on my head.
I was looking from here. It's terrible. Like, I think that's why, yeah, one of the reasons why I'm just going solo. It's like, oh my God, like I can't just, from Regina, Saskatoon, right, just getting to Columbus was a pain. Like, I'm like, there's no direct, I was going to even drive across the border to like Minot or Fargo and take a direct flight. And there's nothing.
You have to drive all the way to Minneapolis, probably.
And then you still got to like bounce around.
How far is Minneapolis from you?
I'll check. That's not a bad idea, but I think it's pretty far because we drove that. It's probably 14 hours, I would say.
And then it's probably, that's because I swear that I seen a flight that went through Minneapolis.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Because that's where that's where the direct Regina flight. See, that's where I'm going to have to go from Regina to Minneapolis, I think.
But
that's
then when I was thinking about suggesting it to you, because I thought about you. I was like, oh, Graham's thinking about driving. I should let him know he could fly from Minneapolis. But then I was thinking about the time we drove to Minneapolis, and I was like, man, that was a fucking far drive to Minneapolis. So that's going to be a long drive. So I get the sense it's going to be like 18-hour drive for you, I bet.
Yeah.
And then you still got to fly. And the worst part is going to be after the weekend. When you finish off the weekend and then you fly back to Minneapolis and you got to hop in your car and drive for a fucking day and a half.
No, I was closer. It's 14 hours, 13 hours.
Oh, yeah, but it's going to take you at least 16 by the time you stop for gas. And I mean, not to mention it's going to cost you. It's almost, you could probably almost fly for cheaper.
It'll cost me $200 in gas.
Probably. If you're by yourself, it's almost cheaper to fly.
Yeah.
Sometimes now.
Yeah.
As soon as you get the main rub is that you can fit 2, 3, 4, 5 people in a car and it still costs you the same amount for fuel. But like the flights, when I brought Mama out this last time, I think it was like, around $300 return. And it's like, I couldn't drive to Winnipeg and back for $300. There's not, maybe if I had a little 4-cylinder car and I drove pretty slow, but I don't even know. I mean, I haven't done it in a while, but I remember it being a few $100, like at least it's going to take me at least 2 tanks to get to Winnipeg. So that's at least, you know, that's almost $400 right there. At today's prices, I'm looking at almost $1,000 to drive to Winnipeg and back. So cheaper to fly if you're by yourself. So what, you're gonna fly then? So you got like probably,
I don't know, I mean, I still don't know, but probably I'll probably fly from Regina
because it's what, 20 hours to Serpomount?
Yeah, more than that.
that's too much. Yeah, well, that's good. Let me know where you're flying. I'm going through Montreal on the way there.
That's the problem. I was like, had to go to Toronto, I think. Because the problem is I don't want to wait. Like, I need to get there at a decent time, right? I can't just get there in the middle of the night or whatever. So then I'm wasting a whole extra day.
Unless they go on the 18th. Yeah, I see what you mean.
Anyways, we'll figure it out. I'll figure it out.
Yeah, well, anyway, I go to Montreal there, and then on the way back, I'm through
Toronto.
Yeah. Which aren't short flights. I mean, those are 4, 4.5 hours.
Well, that's what I'm saying is what's so frustrating with the flying these days. You got to go all over the place to get to your destination. You're flying way out of your way. Instead of just going down there, straight there, you got to go way over to the east and then down.
My other two options were, so I had one through Boston, one through New York, one through Atlanta, and one through Orlando. Can you imagine flying all the way to Florida?
I can't do it just on principle. Like, I gotta fly like 2 hours past my destination, then come back.
Fly right over top of it, probably. Hey, look, there it is. There's a Serpomount. It's eating well. Yeah, I can't see. I think Kyle had to do that last time, fly over us and creek or something, so he could turn around to all the way to, I forget where we were, but he had to fly to San Francisco and back. I was like, God, that's crazy. But
you seem to think it's in a, it's they've done their homework, but I think the airlines are.
Oh yeah, they've done their homework, man. There's, you know, you think the machine, you think the giant fucking machine hasn't just crunched those numbers. It might not even be a lot. It might be like fucking 1%. Here's the thing. Like I always said, I'll pay an extra I'll pay an extra 10%, charge you an extra $50 a ticket or whatever it is, $80 a ticket, but take like 10% of the seats out of the plane, redistribute them accordingly. So now, you know, I've got room to stretch out. I got, you know, I'll pay. That's if they don't even have to try that hard to make it a little bit better, but seems like they're probably going to go in the opposite direction where in economy, we're going to have to stand up. And then first class will get even better.
They should just come up with a thing where they just knock you out and lie you in a coffin type thing. Stack them in there.
Like drawers?
Knock you out and just wake you up when you get there.
Like that Seinfeld where Kramer was fucking putting Chinaman in his dresser.
Yeah. You just get there. It might as well just be like space travel, like a sci-fi thing where you come out of your soma. And you're there, you know? Let's just soma me to my next destination, please.
You don't want the airlines being in charge of your consciousness.
No, I know. Just put it.
Asking for just, trouble.
Just take, well, put my consciousness somewhere else, in a computer somewhere, store it for a bit, just get my body out cold, and then.
The one thing, I mean, it does look like.
Geez, now we're getting into 12 Hawks' new book.
I've never got, I don't fly. I get to fly business class once in a blue moon because I think the thing is on these short flights around the North America, sometimes you get it where it's by the time you, because now it's like check, oh, here's your price. Unless, oh, you want to check, you want to bring a carry-on bag? No, that's extra, bro. Oh, you have another bag too? Oh, that's extra too, bro. Oh, now you want to pick your seat. You greedy bastard.
Oh, it's all a la carte. It's ridiculous.
Everything's an add-on. But, I mean, from what I can see, it looks like first class has come a long way since I was, like, first started flying. Like, it was always just, like, and I might be naive on this because all of my, like, younger flying has all been, like, in Canada. So it was never, like, a super long hauler. But I remember them always just having, like, nicer, bigger seats. And less of them, and more leg room, and better service. They didn't have like a fucking pod with a little thing that closes, and you can lie down in it. And did they have all that all the time?
No, of course not. But they don't. They only have that on certain flights too. I mean, they're not.
Like the pod's taken over. I mean,
well, on the long, maybe on the long flights, whatever. But
it seems like all the ones that have the extra rows in them now have the pods in the front.
Yeah.
I mean, you give me a pod, dude. Yeah, we can fly anywhere. I'm good. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. Give me the Soma pod.
No, I don't. Maybe that's just an option. There's like a little mass that comes down. You can gas yourself out. You gas yourself out, and the flight attendant comes by and puts the mask away and tucks you in. Automatically calls her, gas yourself. So she comes and brings a blanket, tucks you in. But people abuse that, you know. It'll be a nightmare. The system will break. Everybody's gassed. The pilot's gassed. All of a sudden, you're in the middle of a fucking Langoliers movie. Remember that shit?
Yeah.
I was thinking because someone was talking about on the trip about the Stephen King airport movie, and I automatically went to the Langoliers. But I think you mentioned Tommyknockers. I don't even know if I've seen that one.
I didn't mention Tommyknockers, I don't think.
Did someone else, is that about an airport too?
I don't know.
Oh, you remember the Langoliers though, where they like slip just a couple minutes behind the timeline? That'd be an interesting one to rewatch. Mm-hmm. I remember watching it back in the day and I was just like, whoa, what is going on? This is a paradigm breaking movie. Anyway, so we do have... All this to say we're going to Serpamount. Really, we should finish that thought. Where all this flight talk is because we're getting ready to travel again in exactly a month from now. We'll be kicking off the celebrations right at this time. It's 4 o'clock right now. That's when it starts. That's exactly 1 month from when I'm talking. We'll be kicking off Serpamount, having a time. Graham's coming. Everyone's coming. Ollie's coming. Dave Matheson's coming. Brandon Powell's coming. He's bringing all his tanks and stuff from home because he's driving. So we're going to have some excellent ice bath scenes. Have some breath work going on. Dave Matheson there to show us all the star stuff. And of course, he's bringing his lovely wife, Ksenia. So other options for readings and stuff like that, astrology stuff. Dave will have his laser to show you the stars. So all this coming up. Then you can even come over to the Serpent Mound thing on the solstice on the 21st at noon. I'll be giving a presentation, Adam and Eve in the Great Reset. So that's coming up. If you want to check that out. I think the day before I got interviewed Jeffrey Wilson on the main stage on the Saturday. So all that plus Oliver's home cooking. That's go to contact@thecabin.com. There's a few spots left for that. There's a few camping spots left. I think there's a couple private rooms left. So now if you want to jump in, now's the time. Good event. 4 days, all inclusive. We're going to have a time back and forth. From the Serpent Mound Festival to our own little solstice festival over at the Airbnb, which does look fabulous. It's got an amazing outdoor kitchen and bar for Oliver to work in. I mean, he's really going to be in his element. I mean, it's going to be something. I don't know what we were talking menu, but I don't remember what it was, but we'll have Oliver knocks it out of the park with the food. Oh, and the other thing I'll mention is we're bringing back an old classic because Tori's got the newborn baby now. So he can't come and help with the cooking this time. So we're bringing back classic contact at the cabin cook, Keith Winchester, coming back out of retirement to help Oliver cook at the event. So,
oh my God, that's awesome.
Yeah. He was at the very original CAC cooking. Yeah.
Those are the cooks that held that event together. I mean, if it wasn't for the cooks at that event, oh my God.
I mean, those guys got us off the ground. We owe him a debt of gratitude. So it'll be exciting to see him again, hang out with him, and we're going to eat a bunch of great food, have a great time, do some stuff, presentations. Very good chill event. Some of our stuff, like even the Duck Creek one was a bit of a scramble, you know, because we had a lot of stuff to fit into those. It wasn't long drives, but it's still a lot. You got to go to the Bryce, you got to go to Zion. Not that it's terrible, it's fun.
But they're long days though, because when you go somewhere like that and then you spend like 10 days hiking around or 10 hours hiking around and, you know.
Then you get back, everyone's tired.
Yeah.
And they got to be up by a certain time the next morning. So Serpent Mound's another one where we slip into this vibe where there's not a ton to do while we're there that we have to, I mean, the breath work's going to be early in the morning, but we're not like running and driving a couple hours to go do anything. It's just all right there, very close. So if that excites you, check that out. Like I mentioned, we have that Easter Island. We also have the Malta trip, which is approaching like 50% sold already or deposited on. So if people want to get in on that, get that deposit in now. And then we've got the two Randall Carlson events coming up. I'm in the process of talking to your buddies at SurePrint. Do you remember them?
Yeah. He was great.
I've been emailing back and forth with him today.
Yeah, he is great, that guy.
Yeah, he still seems great. I mean, the prices have gone up. But, I mean, I don't see how you can make any money selling t-shirts now. Other than, yeah. I mean, shout out to Sean, friend of the show, Sean, who's launching a t-shirt thing. He's, I don't know, if he wasn't out on the East Coast right now and I wasn't in a hurry, that's naturally who I would have went to. But I know he's out on the East Coast working right now and I need these things in like few weeks. So but I think that the cheapest is like $15 a shirt. So now if you think you gotta take that back to your house and
mail it
to someone. So I mean, even by the time you mail that in Canada, that's another $10 to $15. So it's like, if I'm not selling the shirt for $50, I mean I risk losing money by the time, or at the minimum, I'm making like a super low hourly rate for mail. That's why we got out of the shirts. It wasn't feasible to mail the fucking thing.
Sometimes I mean, we have some shirts on our Redbub. What's the site?
America.ca/swag.
Yeah.
A bunch of shirts also,
but yeah, that's
the only way to do it. And the way Sean's doing it is he's a t-shirt company. That's a little bit different. We're a podcast that just happens to sell t-shirts. Like a half dozen a year to a dozen, if we're lucky. You know, I think Trevor buys most of them. Honestly, when I seen him at CAC, I was like, that's who's buying the shirts. He's got every one of them, he's got the whole collection.
No doubt. I remember somebody saying back with the, when we were doing the events, like the Paradigm Symposium and all that, they're like, shirts never, you know, you'll never just make up enough money when you buy shirts for an event or whatever. It's, or when you try and sell shirts in an event. So I got some feedback too, if you're ready for some feedback.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's what I'm getting them for, unfortunately. I mean, not really. I'm just getting, mostly I'm getting them so that everyone at the event gets one.
Yeah.
As usual. Yeah,
that's different.
And then there might be a few left over to throw at Nikki's booth. I was actually going to ask you if you thought we should, if I should pre-order some, and it might be too late already, but I should have pre-ordered some. If we got them to a US address, it might not be, but maybe some Adam and Eve books. Might be worth having 20 or 30 of those kicking around.
Yeah. I mean, even if you sell them, is it worth it?
Well, I think
getting them, printing them, hauling them around. I mean, maybe it's,
you can get them pretty cheap. It's the shipping that kills you. But if you get like 20 of them, we could probably get them for like a couple bucks. Because the problem with the books, this is the problem with the books. The reason we can't sell the books as cheap as we'd like to is because I have to mark them all down 55% in order to be appearing like Amazon, Barnes and Noble, all these places. You have to do a 55% markdown on your price, and then that's what you're setting your margins at. So anyway, all that to say, I think we can get the books for like $350 a piece if we get a bunch of them.
Well, that'd be
and then another probably $350 or $4 a piece in shipping.
I mean, it's yeah, I think it'd be worth it. Yeah, might as well. Let's try it.
Sell them for $15 or something like
that. Yeah, exactly what I was thinking. $15, yeah.
What a great business meeting. All right, let's have your feedback.
Well, this is
wait, before you do your feedback, there's something we've got to mention we didn't mention yet, is Gordon White.
I know. Gordon White is gone.
True tragedy.
He's moved on.
Yeah.
The next level.
We lost a few.
He's leveled up. Yeah.
We lost over a dozen past guests, but they were all like, other than Dave McGowan, who was already sick when we were talking to him, or on the verge of being sick, one of the two, all the rest of them to a person were like pretty old, you know?
Well, not Carmen Bolter. She was pretty young, too.
Was she?
Yeah.
She wasn't that young, though. She wasn't Gordon. Gordon's younger than me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. That is weird. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Yeah, most of the people have been old that, you know, that we've had on and that are part of our RAP crowd. But Gordon was a hit me. Gordon hit me pretty hard. It hit me harder because I was just thinking about having him on the show again. We got to talk about getting him on the show again because we talked to him every couple of years.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And tough one for Greg, too. I mean, they were especially close. So,
yeah.
Rest in peace, Gordon. Thoughts are with you, Greg, and everyone else. Gordon touched a lot of people. So,
yeah.
All right. Give us the feedback. Because here's the thing. I got no new supporters to mention this week. No one-time donations to mention. I don't know what to say other than support the show. America.ca/support. I know it's tough times out there. They're getting more and more people canceling, unfortunately, because of and telling us it's because life's getting too expensive.
Yeah.
We know what the feeling is up here. So if you can, more important than ever, if you can afford to, that you head over to grandamerica.ca/support today. Sign up for monthly or make a one-time donation.
Look, man, I think we've done a lot, like a pretty good string of episodes. We've had like Avital Levy on about, you know, families, Scott Crichton about the Giza hoax, the pyramid stuff, Dr. Edith Ubuntu Chan, and we've got 12 Hawks next. And then after this, we've got the monk Run Yu. I probably pronounced it wrong. Amazing episode with him too. Ethical Skeptic, we just recorded with, it's coming up. I mean, this is like a massive string of amazing episodes. And this one was, this feedback was from Dr. Edith Ubuntu Chan. Man, this lady's energy was so energetic and cute. You guys both asked great questions and were so dialed in. Amazing interview, man. So that's just from somebody that listens to the show for a while. Shane, thanks for the feedback. And just felt like, you know, it was that good that they needed to email in. So I appreciate that. And I have a synchronicity from a longtime friend of the show, listener.
Ooh, really?
From Gary.
Gary.
Yeah.
Gary.
Probably Gary that'll be at the Serpent Mound.
Interesting. I don't think he's fully committed yet, but rumor is he's coming.
Here's a synchronicity for you. Over the winter, I went through a really rough stretch mentally and spent well over a month in a really, really dark place. My wife had just come back from a Joe Dispenza meditation workshop, and I decided to start meditating too. Joe Dispenza is pretty amazing, actually. Recently, I shifted away from those teachings towards something that feels more aligned with me personally. I came across, so I guess he's decided to do the med, then more recently he shifted away. He came across the word moksha and started looking into its meaning, which led me to symbols connecting to it, one being the Enzo circle. Turns out it's the exact same symbol I've had tattooed on my shoulder for probably 10 years. I originally got it simply because I liked how balanced and meaningful it looked. But at the time, I had no idea what it actually represented. Nuts, man. As always, love the show and proud to support it. Best, Gary. So thanks, Gary. That's, I love that. Imagine getting a symbol and you're resonated to look up this word and all the meanings 10 years later after meditating and then you find out.
I think you would have done that before you got the symbol.
No, because it's just fun. It's just, you know, it's just a symbol. Look at all the your tattoos. I'm sure you don't know the meaning of all those. I mean, geez.
I know the music notes.
It reminds me of that one synchronicity that was like one of our best ever was a guy working for the movies or whatever. Remember when he went to what do you call that when you try out for something?
Audition.
And this weird, really weird like movie with the main star or one of the people that he was auditioning for, I don't know if it was the main star, but the actor that he was auditioning for had these two weird tattoos, like a barcode and some other weird tattoo. And he went to the audition and he had both those tattoos already. Do you remember that one?
That's a good one. Yeah. You know, Laird Scranton had a good one too.
Yeah.
I do remember that.
I had one today, just after our episode with Ethical Skeptic.
Did you?
I was going to send you the picture.
I want a good skull for my synchronicity.
Well, give it to us.
Darryl might give it to me.
Hang on. I'm just waiting for that. Wow.
Ooh, yeah.
So we're talking about pole shifts constantly on the show with Ethical Skeptic, right? And all that.
It was the topic of the show.
Yeah. So then I pop open this book I'm reading. I'm reading part two of The Last Man by Shelley. It's an apocalyptic book. And out of the blue, it's like, not so far as you may suppose, observed a little old astronomer named Merivale. The poles proceed slowly but securely. In 100,000 years, we shall all be underground, said Ryland. Response. The pole of the earth will coincide with the pole of the ecliptic, continued the astronomer. And universal spring will be produced and earth will become a paradise. So it just came out of the blue, this stuff about the pole shift in this book that I'm reading.
Well, hopefully it will be a paradise.
Yeah.
You should have saved that for the Ethical Skeptic episode.
It was after the episode.
I know, but I mean the intro for it.
The intro for it. Oh, no, that's too long.
Too long.
This happened today. This happened a couple hours ago. So.
All right. We'll support the show, you guys, so that we can read your note next week. America.ca/support. Sign up for monthly or make a one-time donation. If you are getting some value from our little podcast over here, tell your friends about it, share it, spin it around, all that sort of stuff. Most of all, do you have a bio?
Yeah. John 12 Hawks is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Traveler. the first book in a trilogy that includes The Dark River and The Golden City, the Fourth Realm trilogy that's been translated into 25 languages. Known as JTH by his readers, Hawks followed the trilogy with Spark, a standalone novel and a nonfiction book, Against Authority, Freedom and the Rise of the Surveillance States. His readers have been translated this ebook into multiple languages. For more than 20 years, he's deliberately lived an anonymous life to show his resistance to the continual government and corporate attack on privacy. He has discussed his life choices in a published essay, Writing as the Sky Rains Death. He worked as a war correspondent, turned to fiction to understand a fractured reality. Like several of his characters, he has lived in London, New York, Paris, and Berlin. So he's been around, and he's got a Substack. Now I'm just going to go over the Substack. Is substack.com at John12Hawks. There's a link to his book, Penguin Random House, book in the show notes, John12Hawks.com as well. We'll also get you there. And I'm going to just read a thing about the book. It's pretty, really a cool book. And Scott Brick, one of the most famous narrators, narrates it. The same narrator he had 20 years ago for his Traveler book. He returns
better 20 years ago
with a masterful journey through the near future of artificial intelligence, in which a wise orphaned 10-year-old girl goes on the run with only her trusty interactive toy to guide her toward New York City, where a dark landscape and perhaps a hidden hero await her. So yeah, it's getting good response.
And yeah, I wonder how many titles Scott Brick has, buddy. Pretty soon you're going to be up at the top of that list.
No, I can't. He's got way, way, way too many. I don't understand how they can read so much. These guys.
How many does he have?
Books. Oh, I don't know, but I mean, they read these long books. It's unbelievable. I can't narrate for that long without going nuts. I don't know how they do it.
I'm checking. I'm
searching. Either lose my voice or lose my mind.
992, that can't be right.
Yeah, that's about right.
Really?
Yeah, probably.
Well, it's going to take you a minute. It's going to take you a minute to get to 992. Yeah, you like a quarter brick? All right, guys. Enjoy the chat with Jonathan 12 Hawks.
We're here with John 12 Hawks. I've been looking forward to this for years. John, thanks for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you both. And I'm glad that you got back from Easter Island.
Well, it was a bit weird going out there in the middle of the Pacific, like literally in the middle. Like it's the third most remote island in the world. So it was pretty weird.
Oh.
But I've been thinking about doing this chat for many years because, I mean, we're going to get into the launch of Certainty. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about that. I just listened to it. It was a great book, a super fun read. It did remind me a little bit about your older stuff. And that's what I've been anxious to talk to you because I had an experience. So I want to just talk a little bit about your fame from the earlier book series that you did. I was in a library in Vancouver. So this would have been 20 years ago.
Right.
And some guy handed me, I mean, maybe it was you, I don't know, but some guy handed me The Traveler.
Right.
And I was renting audiobooks. So this was back when I rented the CDs and then I would go home and put them on my iPod and then bring them back to the library. So I listened to The Traveler. So that was Scott Brick, the narrator back then 20 years ago. And he also narrated Certainty.
Wonderful narrator. Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. So was, It was pretty interesting reading, listening to all your books back then, and now 20 years later, you came out with another one. But you've had stuff in between, but, and then I've got another synchronicity story to tell about your stuff too. But, yeah, that was interesting. The first, I guess it was a trilogy, right? The Fourth Round books.
Right. And yeah. Then came a standalone book called Spark, which is about a guy who thinks that he's dead. He has something called Cotard syndrome. And because he thinks he's dead, he has no fear, which means he can become a perfect assassin. And because he's already dead, he can't be killed. So that book is about what is a human being? What makes us human? What makes us worthy of walking on this earth, basically? So,
yeah. And then, so what was your experience like after The Traveler kind of getting, I mean, you must've got pretty famous or a little popular then. And did you decide to go live off grid or something like that? Did you kind of stay anonymous?
No, I mean, I basically made a choice. The Traveler and the trilogy was about the end of privacy in our digital world and the introduction of corporations and also governments basically using surveillance for means of political control. It seemed to be the essence of hypocrisy to say that in my writing and not illustrate that in my own behavior. Okay. So what would you think about a guy who's saying, well, privacy's over with, but let me tell you about my childhood.
Okay. Well, it was fiction. I mean, it was fiction. So, well,
I basically believe, you know, what it is. So I made that choice. I thought people would recognize it. What was odd is that in that opening year, I was basically roundly condemned by everybody.
Wow.
Because I did something very non-American, which is that I turned down fame. And there's an awful lot of writers out there was going, well, you know, it's a marketing ploy or something like that. It's changed. In the last 20 years, it's entirely changed. People have now accepted it. And there's a very different view of writers making choices or artists making choices. A crucial element of this is for the artist Banksy, who I have met several times, was his identity was revealed, as was the real identity of the Italian writer Elena Ferrante. In both cases, the journalist who did the revelation felt everyone's going to love us because we figured out this clue. They were roundly condemned. Everybody basically told them to fuck off because if this person had made a choice about their life, why do you get to go around against their will and explain their birth name? So
yeah,
the attitude has changed radically, I think.
Well, what about 20 years later, the predictions that you made? I mean, not that you made predictions, but you outlined sort of a society, a surveillance society. And for me, it reminded me, and I don't know if it's your novel that reminded me of the UK or the UK that reminded me of your novel.
Right.
But all the CCTV footage like that seemed to be, the UK seemed to be a little bit ahead. And I can't remember if you were writing about that being the potential or if it's the other way around for me.
But. It was just beginning when I was writing the book. I was living like in London for part of the time, and there were these advertisements on the tube with a picture of a CCTV camera, and then underneath for the words "safe beneath watchful eyes."
Oh my God!
I really started to get kind of pissed off by this. I said, who are the eyes? How do I know they're watchful? And maybe I don't really want them watching me. Okay. So, I'm actually, I think, one of the few writers that have actually predicted something, which is almost 90% come true. So what can I say?
And is that kind of why you decided to write certainty? Because you can see what's happening with AI and with,
yeah,
with that now.
Just more trying to understand what was going on. I hadn't published a book for 10 years. There's two different reasons behind that. I mean, people always say, publishers say, editors say, agents say, we really want to get your next book. We really want to read your next book. That turns out to be not true. What they really want is to read your next good book. Okay, so I feel very responsible and connected to my readers. I really wanted to give them something which was a good book, but I also needed to understand this new world of AI that was starting. And I talked to a lot of people, some of them experts in their field, trying to understand this world that we are now in right now, you know, and which is extremely significant for the future of human beings, I think.
Yeah.
Can you unpack that a little bit? Because from where I'm sitting, it seems like we kind of have two roads in front of us, and maybe it's been the same two roads we've always had, but it's like, in my personal experience, at least, it's like some people are using some of these tools on to make themselves better, to find autonomy, to create value in the world, and they're being rewarded for it. And other people are using it to, you know, find new porn or fake porn, or, you know, these scales that you can use it for either, with this sort of underlying role towards tyranny in the background that seems to be harder and harder to pull apart from just the general human experience. It seems just like what we like to do. Maybe we don't like to do it, but that seems to be what we do throughout history. So I guess if the question would be, do these tools give us a better opportunity to put, because it seems like they A, give us a better opportunity to push back against those mechanisms, and B, also give those mechanisms a more powerful way to operate.
I am not a neo-Luddite. The technology is here, and I actually use it. The technology described in the book already exists. What's changing is how much authority we give that new technology. Okay, so it's most people don't experience this as control. They experience it as convenience, all right? What fiction lets you do, and the reason why I wrote the novel, is that you can watch the consequences play out in terms of what happens with the characters. Instead of arguing about this or saying, well, I use AI for this and it's good, I push things a bit forward and so try not to make a judgment call. Just try to show you how it affects different people's lives. I think the book has one of the first realistic scenes of one of the characters uses a sex bot. There's a chapter where he goes and meets up with a sex bot. I know way too much about sex bots, how they work, where they come from, and everything involved with them. So I do the research, I have a character, I follow that character into like a situation, and rather than arguing about tech is good or tech is bad, I try to show what the human implications of it are.
The control thing is a good point, because I mean, I was looking at that in real time yesterday as something that people don't understand, as these models are being messed with in the background. Like when I was trying to look at some Henta virus or whatever it is stuff yesterday, like my model shut down in the middle of it for a safety protocol and was like, we can't fucking talk about this right now. And I know why we can't talk about it right now. It's because they've just put this block in place until they can figure out the coding on the back end to what's acceptable and what's not to disseminate to the public.
So, and oddly enough, it's you two guys should be the ones talking about it right now, because you're able to communicate to a lot of other people, okay? And it's just who's controlling access to information, and how is that information shaped, perhaps?
Which information warrants controlling?
Absolutely correct, Darren. That's the entire point. So the new novel, Certainty, is not a Luddite novel, but it's about the human experience in a variety of different ways. One of the things I would say every single thing described in the new novel either exists now or will probably exist within the next 5 years. One thing which is mentioned is that the people in the book have gone through a horrible pandemic. And what is now occurring in real life now is that people miss a person who has died, and you can hire services that will give you a holograph of the person who died, who will use recordings of that person's voice so you can hear the person's voice when you come home. You can talk to your dead mother if you want to. And okay, there's nothing wrong with that, but what are the human implications of that? That's what a fiction writer and novelist can do.
Yeah, I like it because I keep coming back to the fact that it's so ingrained already in our society that we have to kind of get through to where you're talking about, where you can kind of, we need to discern between what's going to be allowable and what's not going to be allowable. Like, for example, in Canada, you know, you can't really do much without a smartphone. Like you have to, if you're connecting to the government or you're going to go to a sports game downtown, like you need a smartphone now to do all kinds of stuff. Like there's pretty much no, no question about it now. So I think we have to reach a point where we become okay with the digital environment, and they know where the boundaries are with controlling us and all that. I don't know if we can ever get there, but to me, it seems like we have to go through some stuff to get to that other side.
So what kind of drives me crazy is that you two guys, and I would also say also your listeners, are attuned to what the change is and to what's actually going on. But if you look and see, at least in America, what kinds of stories and characters writers are doing for fiction, it's basically about the adultery of the upper middle class. Okay, I mean, it's all these major changes are going on, and I don't see an awful lot of writers trying to confront as to how should we regard this, how should we act, is it good, is it bad, what should we feel about it. Parts of the book are actually playful. Kate, a 10-year-old girl who has these long conversations with an AI stuffed harp seal, encounters this guy who lives out in the woods in a cabin. He's lonely, so he's purchased software, AI software, and a vest. He's put it on his three dogs so he can talk to his dogs and have a conversation with his dogs. Now, I think that's wonderful. I would like to talk to a dog as well. What are the implications of that? How does that make you feel? Is it going to be a society where people would rather talk to their always nice AI companions, or is something different going to happen?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I mean, for me, it's more about people could do what they want in that regard, but it's like there's going to be some, you know, like let's say the social credit system and like being, you know, us being, let's say like a UBI comes out recently and, or in the next little while and, you know, we get a certain amount of money a month, but we have to comply with all these things and we can only eat so much beef or whatever. I mean, there's all these control mechanisms that can be put in place that we're going to have to resist at some point.
Right. So, and I think that unfortunately, at least in the States, I'm not sure about Canada, but the quality of discourse is fairly low right now in terms of, you know, people have already made up their minds about things. People are flaming different people online. I'm not trying to do that. I'm not trying to make some lectury type argument. I'm creating a fictional world with interesting characters, and this is how they live their lives, and this is how you might be living your life in the future, in the next 5 years. What do you feel about it? What do you want? What makes you happy? What do you think a human being is or should be? Those are the questions.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah. it was a really good book. I recommend it to people. I love the part about the two kind of like the humans wanting to become robots and the robots needing to look human.
Yeah, there's a thing called the Uncanny Valley.
Yeah.
About this or?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's basically like a robot that the 10-year-old girl talks to, and the Uncanny Valley for your listeners that haven't heard about it. If you are perfectly beautiful and without any kind of imperfection as a statue or a robot, you start to make people feel uncomfortable. So the way to make yourself more attractive as a robot is to have like imperfections. So that there's something wrong with your nose a little bit. That's how human beings are geared to think this is a real human being because it's not absolutely perfect.
I like it. Darren, you got any questions?
Well, I'm kind of curious as to where you see what are the sort of options out in front of us and which ones you think are the most prevalent right now.
So after I wrote the trilogy, I'm going to go back, I think, one step. I wrote a free nonfiction book called Against Authority, Freedom and the Rise of the Surveillance States. This book has been translated into 5 different languages. It's gotten me into a lot of trouble. And it's about the implications of that and what kind of life you can have. One of the things which I actually recommend towards the end, toward that whole kind of surveillance thing, is that we should deliberately and consistently create parallel identities. A identity for the internet, an identity for watching porn. I think people already do this already, but to be organized about it and be conscious of what we are showing and what we decided not to show other people. So that's about like surveillance. As far as AI goes, it's you need to figure out what enables you to be the self that is authentic to you, okay? And if AI gives you the tools to do that, to be more who Darren is or more who Graham is, more Grahamness, okay, then it's a good thing. But when AI starts to influence the way you are and starts to influence your behavior, how you see things, how you talk, how to react to other people, that's where the danger comes. You have to be conscious of what your choices are as a human being.
Is that a new danger? Because it seems to me like most of the problems through history are kind of based on that same emulation, just it hasn't been a robot, it's just been some other asshole that turns out to be full of problems.
It's the same, it's the exact, that's a very astute comment. It's the exact same danger, but it's easier now. Because here's this kind voice. People sometimes prefer to talk to Claude or talk to ChatGPT because they're always going to be nicer. They're always going to be supportive. Okay, it's always there, but the package is much more insightful about you, adjustable to who you are, and pervasive on a daily level. It's okay if you want to use it to make your life happier or more comfortable, but you have to be aware of what is going on. What is the impact of your life? I have talked to people who probably talk more to AI systems on a daily basis than they do to other human beings. All right. And I don't think that's necessarily good for our world.
Well, I would add to that that it's just like another level of obfuscate. It's just another level of murk to who's running the show. Like to me, this is like the it's a continuation of this democracy scam that they pulled on us, where that, you know, the rulers have never changed, but now it's Graham's fault that I ain't got shit, or it's someone else's fault. It's a Democrat's fault. It's a Republican's fault. It's a liberal's fault. It's a conservative's fault, but it's never the ruler's fault. And now this is going to do the same thing with sort of science and these other sort of spaces, where it's like, there won't be a Fauci to yell at anymore because it was just Claude. I mean, you know, we don't know where Claude came up with it.
Right. So we've created something which is the equivalent of, towards the end of the movie and the book, The Wizard of Oz. It's the same thing behind the curtain, but now because of this technology, it's exactly what you said. It's murkier. It's harder to pull back the curtain. It's harder to see what's really behind there.
Does that go even further back? Is it just more Plato's cave?
They were living a day-to-day life. I think Plato's cave is much more about, do ideals have a reality? So I'll give you like an easy question. Do mathematic equations exist because of humans, or do they exist independently and are just floating around for humans to find them? So that's really what that is in Plato. But
I would say math exists because a monkey did it.
Okay. All right. I don't know if I would say that about quantum theory, but okay.
Yeah, I would at the further end
Yeah.
But math does still seem to be unique, because it does seem to be the only thing we have that transcends language and culture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even
at least it's closer to the truth than any of the other stuff, you know?
Also, it definitely goes beyond the universe, I would say, Darren. I mean, if you're on another planet, I think that 2 and 2 still equal 4. All right. So
that might be the only, like, none of the other stuff, none of the other laws would probably transcend that except for math, right? Like, the math is probably going to stay the same. It seems like it would have to, but all your other sort of laws are going to change based on the nature of that system.
So going back to the novel, I think the issue for the characters, and also for you two, and also like your listeners, is are you aware of the choices that you're making? It's okay to make any goddamn choice that you want to, as long as you don't hurt anybody. But the problem is, I think, other than this, you two guys and the show and the people listening right now, there's a lack of what I would call critical thinking in terms of, what is the reality? What are the facts? Rather than this kind of murkiness, Darren, that you were talking about. Things seem really murky these days.
I think it's even worse than that. It's not even, it's worse than that, because it's a delegation of responsibility to authority.
Right, right. So all those are there, and that is why perhaps not that many people have written and published a book set in the world of AI, because in order to do that, I had to spend quite a number of years finding out how computers work, how neural computers, how our phones work, okay, how everything works. In order to write the fiction, I had to understand reality. And there's a lot of new technological reality to understand these days,
which must have been weird after 20 years of predicting it coming, right? It must have been surreal in a lot of ways.
Yeah, there were two points in terms of the new novel. I wrote an entire book, a novel, about, are we basically organic robots, or do we have free will? And it was an interesting thing. Then it just turned out to be ridiculous. So I began to kind of look into AI. And I I have talked to a number of experts on this. I went down to Georgetown University, met a major person involved with AI, and it was a fascinating conversation. I took her out for lunch, and towards the end, I said, this is really great. Thanks a lot. What else is going on here at the university that you find is interesting? And she said, psychopaths. I said, what? Very close friend of mine is finding out everything about psychopaths. And I said, what is a psychopath? Really, I'm a little lazy on that. She said that this is a person who wants to have control, who doesn't have a emotional connection, who wants to know everything about you so he or she can manipulate you. And as she's telling me what a human psychopath is, I'm going, you just described what a super intelligent computer is, all right? You are making an all-powerful psychopath whose goal is not necessarily going to be our comfort, whose goal is not to be switched off, all right? That's the system's concept of death. And so that conversation triggered me. I'm on the plane, the train going back up like to New York City, and I get this idea of a 10-year-old girl walking through a city in the rain holding a talking AI stuffed harp seal. And that was the start of the book, basically.
Nice. I love it. I want to circle back to the part you mentioned about parallel identities, because to be honest, it's a bit shocking, because I think, I don't know, I'd like to know what Darren says too, but I think I've been doing the opposite of that. I've been trying to be authentic on the podcast, but not to be like, you know, someone different online than in real life, right? Trying to be one sort of person. So that's a bit of a hard concept for me to sort of realize I probably need to start separating this out, you know?
I even take it one further than that and say, you just have to be the same person all of the time. You know, I mean, maybe your kids and your wife see a slightly different version of you, but other than that, it shouldn't change based on your environment either, you know, which is probably a benefit of not having a boss at the end of the day. Because that's like the ultimate, what work is the ultimate, like, okay, fuck, I got to be in work mode.
I will give you a true life anecdote, and perhaps we'll also show what it is to have my life. I went through some personal changes, lived in Europe for a while, and then moved to New York City. I know a lot of writers and began to go to literary events in New York City, okay? And I couldn't help it. Sometimes I would look around the room and realize I had published more books, 1.5 million, than every single writer in that room combined for their entire life, okay?
Wow.
And yet, okay, people would meet me and would just assume, well, I haven't read about him in the New York Times. He must be nothing. And the little acts of this kind of petty snobbery and bullshit made me think that we don't really know, Darren. We don't really know the secret lives that other people have. We don't really know what's really going on. And that was like a weekly encounter, usually, of that people don't know who you really are, what you really want, and what you're capable of in a positive way. My kids saw it as my ritual Buddhist expression of ego destruction in order to go to these literary parties, because I would really just have to stop wanting to kind of shout at his, you guys know shit about anything. But of course I didn't do that. So there you go.
I can see it. I mean, I just moved to a small town in the middle of nowhere, and so it was a weird experience for me to be like, okay, I'm going to get involved a little bit in the small town, play some hockey, kind of, you know, trying like get social, because if I don't make an effort to be social, everything's just sitting in the office here working, you know, reading books and working on the show and all that, going on the odd trip. But it was weird for me, because I was like, well, how do I talk about all the weird stuff I talk about on the show. Like, right. So I kind of made the choice to kind of just like get to know everybody without mentioning too much until eventually I can kind of pipe up a little bit and not be. Yeah. So it was very, very strange experience. So I kind of compare that to what you're saying here, you know,
what you want in the end is obviously to be friendly with your neighbors, but you also want people to kind of understand you and understand who you are. And if anyone understand who you are truly would have to hear the show. Okay.
Cause otherwise everything's so polarizing right now. Right. I mean, we're in a weird spot. I never would have even thought of that before. Like all of a sudden I'm playing, you know, I haven't played hockey for 12 years. So I'm in a dressing room with a group of guys and it's new. Like all this is different than it was when I used to play hockey. Right. We used to just, you know, talk shit all the time to each other or whatever. And I mean, now it's like, now you gotta be careful what you talk about.
But this is like another element of my life. This is when The Traveler came out. This drove the agent I had at the time. He's not my agent anymore, but it drove him crazy. Maybe, I don't know, for a wide variety of reasons. But for about 2 to 3 years, letters would arrive to the agency, which would have photographs. And the photographs were from a variety of women at various ages saying, I have read your book. You've read my mind. I don't know where you are, but I really want to meet you. And here's how I look in a bathing suit. Okay. This would drive my agent crazy. He's going, here's your phone number. You call her up on the phone. I said, they don't know who I am. And because it's a blank page, it's an empty canvas, they projected the perfect person on canvas. Okay. Why would I want to be with someone who's just projected something that I'm not? Okay. I mean, it's nerve wracking. I couldn't imagine doing it actually.
Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy. Was there any other like experiences that you didn't foresee being off grid for a little while? Like, was it a little harder than you thought? Was it easier? Was it weird coming back? Can you talk about that experience a little bit more in relation to your past and your latest book?
What has made this different in the last 10 years is the rise of social media. So in the past, I could not directly communicate with my readers. It was really hard. You could have a blog or like a website, but now two things have occurred. Podcasts like you guys have, this is like the fifth one I've done, all right? And it's a way that you can reach people that I can reach people, and it's outside the system. It's basically who you are, what you guys personally like or don't like, or what interests you and your listeners, okay? Which is wonderful, okay? That exists. And then I have this time really, really worked on my social media. I have a Substack account. I'm presently looking at, I'm looking at my computer screen, well over 300 messages from readers, and I'm going to answer every single one of them. Okay. There's now a direct way. The problem in the past was I had to go through the publisher. I had to go through institutions. Now I can just do it directly. And that's really, really good. It gives me some real, real, real pleasure. So
that's interesting. It's almost how Scott Adams described when he started putting his email address in the sidebar of Dilbert when it first came out. He's like, it just opened up all of this stuff where it wasn't just the feedback, but also a bunch of different ideas for stories and people telling him about their experience, which you can then work into other comic book strips for him. But I wonder if that sort of same thing happens to you for fiction writing. You get all these personal accounts from all these people that
I get
sort of to be fictionalized.
And incredibly intimate and personal accounts, Darren. And I always answer back. I always try to answer with some degree of affection and also respect. Certain things I will not tolerate. I won't tolerate bigotry, you know, general crazy paranoia, but pretty much all except, I think, most things. And in the past, I could not directly have a connection. Now, through podcasts like yours and through things like Substack, I can totally communicate with my readers. It's great. It's wonderful. I thank you both very much for that, okay? For you are definitely on the crest of the wave. So.
Is it? That's awesome. Is that for better or for worse? Because, I mean, social media, you know, I go back and forth about this all the time because social media has been, you know, good for us in most ways. I'm able to use it in a way that I don't really consume it. You know, I consume it in very small batches. You're able to connect with your readers. We're able to connect with our listeners in a way that wouldn't have been possible before, which enables trips and all these other amazing experiences we're able to have, not just for ourselves, but for the people that come, you know, that we hear all the time, best trip ever, best trip ever, best trip ever. But there's like a rot hiding underneath that, that is probably where like, this general public we're sort of skirting around falls into that, you know, 300 people are using social media to get in contact with you about your book, but 300 people are also, you know, using it to just make shit up, or, you know, we're in this weird sort of cycle with social media where I don't know if it's on the way out or what, but it's sort of evolving into this weird space where we don't know what's real anymore. And it seems to be manufactured in such a way to make us want to kill each other.
I think it's a problem, but then I would actually say that you guys personally refute an element of that argument. So before I agreed to do this podcast, I checked you guys out, and you are who you are. You are completely authentic. You aren't trying to lecture people. You aren't trying to sell something. You aren't trying to, you know, here's a basket full of bullshit. Eat it, okay? I mean, that's why I agreed, because what I think in the end is going to survive and prosper, because you're absolutely right, Dan. There's so much falseness out there. The people who have a grasp on reality will have a sensitivity to what's real and authentic. And yes, the rest of them are just going to want to have a thing which essentially is simulated. That's the real conflict between a simulated experience and an authentic and real one that actually moves your thoughts and touches your heart.
That's interesting. Well, thank you, first of all.
But yeah, we appreciate that.
To hear you say, because that's sort of what we noticed on our trips is that, you know, at this point, we're not even selling the trips are sort of selling themselves, because what we've sort of cultivated is spaces for people to take this sort of podcasting listener relationship into the real world, where then they can, you know, suddenly be at some location, not just there though, they're also there with like 30 people that they can say anything to. We could talk about A, B, or C, or X, Y, and Z, and nobody's going to take it personally or get offended whether they agree with it or not. They're just going to sort of work through it. It's almost like a safety in a way, where you can go there and you can just sort of like, you know, everything sort of just loosens up a little bit. You're sort of releasing tension you didn't even know you were holding.
Right. So that's it. I mean, we, in essence, have like the same goal. I hope that my readers, I hope that some people listening to this are actually going to read the book. And I hope that they get a feeling that I'm not trying to sell anything. I don't have a political or, you know, some kind of weird philosophical view. I'm just trying to show what our current reality is leading us to, and how, what the human element of that is. And that's all that you can really do. You can help people stay in contact with who they really are and what they really care about.
I love it. Yeah. And your type of book is to me one of the best, that where it's fiction, but it's based on a reality, you know, like a fact, like you've done so much research that you can tell that it feels fantastic, but it feels like it's a year away. You know, it's really fascinating.
So yeah, so that's what it is. And exactly like what is up with you guys, I what they always want if you've had a hit is, why can't you write your last book? It's like, no, the world's changed, okay? Things, I've changed, you've changed. You guys are different in the last 5 years, okay?
Yeah.
Just because of the experiences you have had, all right? So I'm constantly trying to challenge myself. I just wrote the text for my first graphic novel, all three books. I'm interviewing illustrators. Spark, the standalone novel, was optioned by the producer that won Best Picture Academy Award for Oppenheimer. I'm working with him about how a film would be. And these are new skills I have to learn, a new world that I have to learn. And sometimes it makes me uncomfortable to kind of do all this, but it's good. It's good to be pushed out of your little whatever and challenge yourself, okay? Just to maybe see something different, accept something.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I love it. Okay, I want to mention.
I was just reading that quote the other day. I forget who it's by, but it's like, if you find yourself the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
I completely and totally agree.
Yeah, that's part of the reason I left my day job is because it was like, I mean, it wasn't completely my decision, but I had been sort of contemplating it for a year and complaining to Graham constantly about this. It's like, man, I'm 40 years old and I'm in a room full of people that I don't feel like I'm learning anymore. The everything is sort of capped off. And I don't feel comfortable being the smartest person in some of these meetings because I'm not supposed to be. There's this whole layer of, and I'm not that smart, just to toot my own horn. You know, I wasn't like the best in the business at what I was doing or anything. I was just proficient at it. And all of a sudden I'm like hearing things in meetings and that are coming out of people's mouths. And it's like, well, you guys know we can't do this. You know, this is like, you know, and it was like, it started off, it was one project. And I'm like, okay. And I remember complaining to Graham about it. I don't know what's going on with this project. But within like 2 years of that, it had sort of spiraled into every project I was on. And it wasn't, a consequence of me getting smarter by any stretch of the imagination. It was like a consequence of the industry dumbing down for a bunch of reasons. You know, people retiring because of COVID and all this other stuff. And all of a sudden there was this, and just I was in the trade. So the trades in general have been sort of neglected for so long, or for 20 or 30 years at least, that there's this missing layer of people in between that were responsible for the knowledge transfer that has now disappeared. And now my concern at being out of industry is I can almost see that in every industry at different, like I think the construction industry, because of sort of the push against blue collar work for decades, where we weren't pushing kids to be mechanics or tradesmen or plumbers or all this sorts of stuff, which at the end of the day, ironically turned out to be the most resilient jobs, but we weren't doing it. So I think it was sort of, exasperated a little bit compared to the rest of the world, but it really seems like I can see that same sort of, you know, it's almost an Ayn Randian sort of rot creeping in from all sorts of angles right now. And it's like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't even know if there's a question there.
No, but I would offer a possible rule is that in terms of any reality, the farther a person is away from that reality, the more certain they are about what should be done and what right thing to do. And it's one of the few bio details I have revealed is that I was a very active war correspondent for actually quite a few years, covered major wars. Okay. And as you were talking, Darren, I remember this thing, I had a call from an editor, the editor's in London. The editor says, there's a lot of fighting up in this town called Goma. It's up in Eastern Congo. I just looked at a map. Why don't you drive up there and see what's going on? Going, do you realize I'll get killed if I do that? No, it's an easy road. You just go straight up there. The more distant a person is, the more sure they are that they know what's right and so on, versus a person who is flipping burgers at McDonald's probably knows more about the day-to-day actions and what's good for that work than the guy who's the corporate president, because he's just seeing pieces of paper.
Yeah. That's a good rule. I like it. I want to mention before, because I'll never forgive myself if I don't tell you about the synchronicity that we had with you many years ago. So we used to talk about listener synchronicities, like listeners would send in their synchronicities to us. And then sometimes we would talk, like Darren would actually rate them. Like we had a whole sort of meme going on about synchronicity. So, and you were involved in one, not, you know, unknowingly, but just with your books and stuff. So I think it was, I'm trying to remember what happened, but it was partly to do with hawks. So I was riding my bike in this huge park in Calgary, and I saw this red-tailed hawk, and it let me ride up right beside it, and it just stared at me in the eyes as I looked by. And I was talking to Darren on the show about this, and what happened after that was I started researching what hawk it was. And then somehow, I think I was listening to one of your books. It might have been, maybe it was like the Golden City or something. And I had switched from my, maybe it, I think this is what happened, but it was something very similar. I switched from my headphones of listening to your book, and I started listening in the car to The Synchronicity Key by David Wilcock. And as soon as I turned it on, he mentioned your name in the book. Like it was like Jonathan 12 Hawks. And I was like, what are the chances that, like, I went from all this hawk research and all this stuff, and then I go in from listening to you to going into The Synchronicity Kid, and he just mentions it right away. That's kind of like a rough summary. I haven't talked about this for so long, but it was pretty cool.
So we are then closely connected, because why I named myself Troll Fox, it was a real experience. I was walking through a forest. I accidentally stumbled on a hawk's nesting site of red-tailed hawks. And
wow.
In order to defend their nest, they began to fly around my head so close that the tips of the wings of one of them brushed against my forehead, okay? And that was such a powerful experience. I mean, if I had been a indigenous person, I would have instantly changed my name to Patrol Fox. I had to wait a decade or so, and then I decided to come up with a name. I picked John because that was my brother-in-law, and 12 Fox because I'd had that experience. So,
oh wow, that's awesome. Yeah, I don't think I ever knew that story about your hawks. That's awesome.
Yeah,
wow. It's a compounding synchro. What are you working on now?
So as I said, the two current projects. One is a graphic novel which is set in the world of people I've now hung out with. Wait, a three-part graphic novel involving the central character is a young crime scene cleaner, okay, who goes to the scenes of horrible murders and cleans them up, and suddenly realizes he's able to sense when people are going to die or not, okay? And so that's the story I'm making of It's more mythological, but it's been awfully fun to kind of.
I love it. We just had a crime scene cleaner come to me to come on the show.
It is like,
what? A crime scene cleaner and organ. Just some weird stuff. It fits very much in with what you're talking about there. What was your What was the second thing you were going to? Second project.
Currently working with. The film.
Right.
Based upon Spark. There you have to somewhat leave your ego out the door, because a film is a group project with the director. I'm working with another screenwriter, and it's just like, okay, well, what works? Okay. It's remarkable that there's a lot of Hollywood films that involve violence. They don't know shit about violence. I mean, it's just astonishing to me. Okay. I mean, I do because of the war correspondent thing. So I've had to explain all of these different things. I mean, they come up with like a Hollywood violence, and it's like, no, it isn't like that. Here, I'll tell you like a war correspondent story. This is what real violence is like. I'm in Kampala. There was a civil war after Idi Amin fled. There's a shootout between the police and the army in the middle of the city. And so I go over there because I'm the only journalist in the entire country. And they're shooting guns at each other. They actually shot an RPG. It flies over my head. And right in the middle of the firefight, a goat appears in the middle of the street. And then 30 seconds later, an old lady runs out in the middle of the firefight. That's her goddamn goat. That's what she gets milk from. And she's going to take that goat. And it's like she grabs the goat. The goat's trying to get away because the goat's scared. Guns are going everywhere. There comes another RPG, whizzes over her head. That's what real violence is. It's not choreographed. It's like shit happens.
It's chaotic. Yeah, yeah.
And you just react to it. So.
Wow, that's awesome. So is Certainty, is a sequel to Certainty coming at all? Or?
I will see. Many people have asked to see what's going to happen to Kate, the 10-year-old, and will Zeno, the talking AI, will they come back? And it was interesting, on Tuesday, got a call from a producer. There's a lot of people who call themselves producers, which really aren't. Okay. And he, connected by my agent and he said, I just want to do a series about the two of them. And you should write another book just about them. Maybe I will, maybe I don't. I wake up in the morning and I hope the same thing. I hope that you two feel the same way in the morning. I wake up in the morning and I feel grateful. I am grateful I'm alive. I'm grateful that I'm still sane. I'm grateful that there's a beautiful world out there.
Grateful that I'm not in the Matrix, mostly. I mean, I'll be honest, that's because everything else is made better by not having to be a pod in the Matrix.
It isn't the fact you take the blue pill or the red pill, Darren. It's the fact whatever you take, you're not aware of it. Okay. It's all about awareness.
Yeah. Well, I equate the Matrix to just like the day-to-day grind that most people have to sell 40 hours of their life every week, which doesn't really leave enough time to properly enjoy the rest.
Right. Right.
And not having to do that is a blessing that, you know, most people never get.
So do you have you guys ever talked about here, because I used to be a journalist, I'm going to turn the tables. What is your favorite kind of listener? You ever talked about that?
No, I don't think so.
Have you ever talked about who you're talking to? It would interest me if you guys have been doing this for like a while. And
yeah, I would say just open-minded, but not too open-minded. Like, I guess it would be sort of like someone like me. I would think that, which is kind of lame, but I would think that, I would hope that it would be someone like me, not too judgmental, but open-minded, I guess. And yeah, I don't know. What do you think, Darren?
Oh, I don't know. For the most part, I don't think about the listener when I'm making the content. It's sort of selfish in that regard. It's my, you know, it's the interviews, especially the good ones, are mostly for me more than they are for anyone else. That's kind of why we started the podcast, and all the other stuff that came along with it were just sort of happy little extras that I would never give up now. But I think I still look at, you know, like I got a show with the Ethical Skeptic next week, and my top priority is figuring out some stuff for my own research, you know, and hopefully the listeners will find that entertaining. And they seem to, you know, at the end of the day. So probably the same answer as Graham, you know, at the end of the day, the listener is me.
Right. Okay, that's there. There's an anecdote, because I now, because of the internet and social media, I can actually communicate with my readers. I've rarely met them in the past. So the second book in the trilogy, The Dark River, came out. I went to my agency. I had to go at night because only my agent knew who I was. No one else did. And he gave me the Danish and the Portuguese edition of the Traveler. So I'm carrying those in a messenger bag. And I go back home on the subway. And all of a sudden, right in front of me is this beautiful young woman. And she's reading The Traveler.
No way.
And I could have gone, hey, I'm John Hawks. And I could have proved it on the spot. I'm like, who the hell would walk around New York with a Danish edition of these books in a messenger bag? And I said to her, so, what do you think of that book? And she looks up to me and she, and all I see is this, she's thinking, this shabbily dressed guy, because I don't dress up very well, is trying to come on to me. And she says, I like it a lot. And then she goes back to the book. I got off two stops later. I walked down the platform, sat down on the bench, and just laughed at my own stupidity and vanity as far as that goes. It was like, okay, I get her, not me. So
she will never know.
Oh, there you go.
John 12 Fox, this has been great. We'll have to do this again soon. Where can people find your work? Where can they buy the books? Where's the best place to keep track of all this stuff?
Available in America, available in Canada, published by Doubleday Canada. So you can buy it hardback, digital, or you can listen to the 11-hour audio version done by the fabulous reader Scott Brick. So any way you want it, it's there for it. I would ask my readers that if they read the book or hear the book, or encountered it in any way, and they like it, put a review on Amazon and or on Goodreads, and contact me if you want to. I always want to hear from you.
You mentioned awesome. Social media. Where can people find that?
You can go to my website, john12fox.com, or you can contact john12fox.com on Substack. So it's there.
Perfect.
There. Yeah. It's there. You guys are as I thought you would be, so I'm really pleased and happy, I have to say. It's like it's good. I'm really, really glad that you've been doing this. I hope it moves forward in the future.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, we really appreciate it. Thank you.
It sounds fun. Okay.
Awesome. Take care.
Thank you, John. Have a great day, and hopefully we'll chat again soon. And that was a chat with John 12 Hawks. We'll have to keep the outro short because we have Christopher in the waiting room. So, big thanks to John for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. We compounded Graham Synchro even more. We'll touch on that in the intro if we remember. But big thanks, John, for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Even bigger thanks if you do choose to support the work at grammerica.ca/support. Check out GrammaticaOutloud.ca for the podcast. Contact at thecabin.com for trips and events. AdultBrain.ca for the audio books and simulationmaps.com to check out our software. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
For God's sakes, time is-